You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Section 21 of the Complete Works of Tacitus, edited by Thomas Gordon. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Graham Redman. The Complete Works of Tacitus, to which are prefixed political discourses upon that author, edited and translated by Thomas Gordon, with introductory essays by Thomas Gordon. Volume 1, The Annals, Book 2, Section 3, Debates in the Senate. Next time the Senate sat, long discourses against the luxury of the city were made by Quintus Haterius, a consular, and by Octavius Fronto, formerly praetor, and a law was passed against using table plate of solid gold, and against men's debasing themselves with gorgeous and effeminate silks. Fronto went farther, and desired that the quantities of silver plate, the expense of furniture, and the number of domestics might be limited. For it was yet common for senators to depart from the present debate, and offer, as their advice, whatever they judged conducing to the interests of the common weal. Against him it was argued by Asinius Gallus that with the growth of the empire private riches were likewise grown, and it was no new thing for citizens to live according to their conditions, but indeed agreeable to the most primitive usage. The ancient Fabricii and the latter Scipios, having different wealth, lived differently, but all suitably to the several stages of the commonwealth. Public poverty was accompanied with domestic, but when the state rose to such a height of magnificence, the magnificence of particulars rose too. As to plate and train and expense, there was no standard of excess or frugality but from the fortunes of men. The law, indeed, had made a distinction between the fortunes of senators and of knights, not for any natural difference between them, but that they who excelled in place, rank, and civil preeminence might excel too in other particulars, such as conduced to the health of the body or to the peace and solacement of the soul, unless it were expected that the most illustrious citizens should sustain the sharpest cares and undergo the heaviest fatigues and dangers, but continue destitute of every alleviation of fatigue and danger and care. Gallus easily prevailed whilst under worthy names he avowed and supported popular vices in an assembly engaged in them. Tiberius, too, had said that it was not a season for reformation, or if there were any corruption of manners there would not be wanting one to correct them. During these transactions Lucius Piso, after he had declaimed bitterly in the Senate against the cabals and intrigues of the Forum, the corruption of the tribunals, and the inhumanity of the pleaders breathing continual terror and impeachments, declared he would entirely relinquish Rome, and retire into a quiet corner of the country far distant and obscure. With these words he left the Senate. Tiberius was provoked, and yet not only soothed him with gentle words, but likewise obliged Piso's relations by their authority or entreaties to retain him. The same Piso gave soon after an equal instance of the indignation of a free spirit by prosecuting a suit against Ergulenia, a lady whom the partial friendship of Livia had set at defiance with the laws. Ergulenia, being carried for protection to the palace, despised the efforts of Piso, so that neither did she submit nor would he desist, notwithstanding the complaints and resentments of Livia that in the prosecution violence and indignity were done to her own person. Tiberius promised to attend the trial and assist Ergulenia, but only promised in civility to his mother, for so far he thought it became him, and thus left the palace, ordering his guards to follow at a distance. People the while crowded about him, and he walked with a slow and composed air. As he lingered and prolonged the time and way with various discourse, the trial went on. Piso would not be mollified by the importunity of his friends, and hence at last the Empress ordered the payment of the money claimed by him. This was the issue of the affair. By it Piso lost no renown, and it signally increased the credit of Tiberius. The power, however, of Ergulenia was so exorbitant to the state that she disdained to appear a witness in a certain cause before the Senate, and, when it had been always usual, even for the Vestal Virgins to attend the forum and courts of justice as oft as their evidence was required, a praetor was sent to examine Ergulenia at her own house. The procrastination which happened this year in the public affairs I should not mention, but that the different opinions of Cnaeus Piso and Asinius Gallus about it are worth knowing. Their dispute was occasioned by a declaration of Tiberius that he was about to be absent, and it was the motion of Piso that for that very reason the prosecution of public business was the rather to be continued, since as in the prince's absence the Senate and Equestrian Order might administer their several parts, the same would become the dignity of the Commonwealth. This was a declaration for liberty, and in it Piso had prevented Gallus, who now in opposition said that nothing sufficiently illustrious nor suiting the dignity of the Roman people could be transacted but under the immediate eye of the Emperor, and therefore the conflux of suitors and the affairs from Italy and the provinces must by all means be reserved for his presence. Tiberius heard and was silent, while the debate was managed on both sides with mighty vehemence, but the adjournment was carried. A debate, too, arose between Gallus and the Emperor, for Gallus moved that the magistrates should be henceforth elected but once every 5 years, that the legates of the legions who had never exercised the praetorships should be appointed praetors, and that the prince should nominate 12 candidates every year. It was not doubted but this motion had a deeper aim, and that by it the secret springs and reserves of imperial power were invaded. But Tiberius, as if he rather apprehended the augmentation of his authority, argued that it was a heavy task upon his moderation to choose so many magistrates, and to postpone so many candidates, that disgusts from disappointments were hardly avoided in yearly elections, though for their solacement fresh hopes remained of approaching success in the next. Now how great must be the hatred, how lasting the resentment of such whose pretensions were to be rejected beyond 5 years! And whence could it be foreseen that in so long a tract of time the same men would continue to have the same dispositions, the same alliances and fortunes? Even an annual designation to power made men imperious. How imperious would it make them if they bore the honour for 5 years? Besides, it would multiply every single magistrate into five, and utterly subvert the laws which had prescribed a proper space for exercising the diligence of the candidates, and for soliciting as well as enjoying preferments. By this speech, in appearance popular, he still retained the spirit and force of the sovereignty. He likewise sustained by gratuities the dignity of some necessitous senators. Hence it was the more wondered that he received with haughtiness and repulse the petition of Marcus Hortulus, a young man of signal quality and manifestly poor. He was the grandson of Hortensius the orator, and had been encouraged by the deified Augustus with a bounty of 1,000 great sesterces to marry for posterity, purely to prevent the extinction of a family so eminently illustrious. The Senate was sitting in the palace, and Hortulus, having set his four children before the door, fixed his eyes now upon the statue of Hortensius, placed amongst the orators, then upon that of Augustus, and instead of speaking to the question then debated, began on this wise: "Conscript fathers, you see there the number and infancy of my children, not mine by my own choice, but in compliance with the advice of the prince. Such, too, was the splendour of my ancestors, that it merited to be perpetuated in their race. But for my own particular, who, marred by the revolution of the times, could not raise wealth, nor engage popular favour, nor cultivate the hereditary fortune of our house, the fortune of eloquence, I deemed it sufficient if, in my narrow circumstances, I lived no disgrace to myself, no burden to others. Commanded by the emperor, I took a wife. Behold the offspring of so many consuls, behold the descendants of so many dictators. Nor is this remembrance invidiously made, but made to move mercy. In the progress of your reign, Caesar, these children may arrive at the honours in your gift. Defend them in the meantime from want. They are the great-grandsons of Hortensius, they are the foster-sons of Augustus." The inclination of the Senate was favourable, an incitement to Tiberius the more eagerly to thwart Hortulus. These were in effect his words: "If all that are poor recur hither for a provision of money to their children, the public will certainly fail, yet particulars never be satiated. Our ancestors, when they permitted a departure from the question to propose somewhat more important to the state, did not therefore permit it that we might here transact domestic matters and augment our private rents, an employment invidious both in the Senate and the prince. Since, whether they grant or deny the petition bounties, either the people or the petitioners will ever be offended. But these, in truth, are not petitions. They are demands made against order and made by surprise. While you are assembled upon other affairs, he stands up and urges your pity by the number and infancy of his children. With the same violence he changes the attack to me, and, as it were, bursts open the exchequer. But if by popular bounties we exhaust it, by rapine and oppression we must supply it. The deified Augustus gave you money, Hortulus, but without solicitation he gave it, and on no condition that it should always be given. Otherwise diligence will languish, sloth will prevail, and men, having no hopes in resources of their own, no anxiety for themselves, but all securely relying on foreign relief, will become private sluggards and public burdens." These and the like reasonings of Tiberius were differently received, with approbation by those whose way it is to extol without distinction all the doings of princes, worthy and unworthy, by most, however, with silence or low and discontented murmurs. Tiberius perceived it, and having paused a little, said his answer was particularly to Hortulus, but if the Senate thought fit he would give his sons 200 great sesterces each. For this all the senators presented their thanks. Only Hortulus said nothing. Perhaps through present awe, or perhaps possessed even in poverty with the grandeur of his ancient nobility. Nor did Tiberius ever show farther pity, though the house of Hortensius was fallen into shameful distress. End of section 21.
Section 22 of the Complete Works of Tacitus, edited by Thomas Gordon. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Claude Banta. The Complete Works of Tacitus, to which are prefixed political discourses upon that author. Edited and translated by Thomas Gordon. Volume 1, The Annals, Book 2, Part 4, Various Rebellions. The same year, the boldness of a single bondman had, but for early prevention, borne the state with great combustions and civil arms. A slave of Posthumus Agrippa, his name Clemens, having learnt the death of Augustus, conceived a design to sail to Planasia, and there, releasing Agrippa by art or force, to carry him to the armies in Germany. No slavish design, but the slowness of the laden vessel defeated his bold purpose, for Agrippa was already murdered. Hence he conceived views still higher and more daring. He stole the funeral ashes, and sailing to Cosa, a promontory of Etruria, hid himself in desert places, till his hair and beard were grown long, for in age and person he was not unlike his master. Then a report spread by trusty emissaries and the associates of the plot, that Agrippa lived, began to thicken. It first crept abroad in dark whispers, as usual in matters of dangerous tendency, but becoming soon a prevailing rumor, it filled the greedy ears of the credulous, or was encouraged by turbulent minds, such as are ever fond of public agitations and changes. He himself, when he entered the neighboring towns, did it in the gloom of the day, never to be seen publicly, nor long in the same place. But, as truth is strengthened by observation and time, lies by haste and uncertainty, he outran fame. Here he stayed not to be known, there he arrived before his name arrived. It flew through Italy in the meantime, that, by the bounty of the gods, Agrippa was preserved. It was even believed at Rome. His supposed arrival at Ostia was celebrated by great multitudes abroad, and in the city by clandestine cabals, whilst divided cares distracted Tiberius, whether he should suppress his slave by the power of the sword, or suffer the empty credulity of the public to vanish with time. Now he thought that nothing was to be slighted, now that everything was not to be dreaded, wavering between shame and fear. At last he committed the affair to Celestius Crispus. Crispus chose two of his creatures, some say two soldiers, and directed them to go directly to him, to feign themselves his adherents, men who were conscious that he was the genuine Agrippa, to present him with money, and to promise him, without reserve, their faith and fortunes. They instantly executed these orders, and afterwards, spying him one night without guards, and being themselves furnished with a proper band of men, they carried him to the palace, gagged and bound. To Tiberius, when he asked him how he was become Agrippa, he is said to have answered, "Just as you became Caesar." But to discover his accomplices, he could never be constrained. Neither dared Tiberius venture to execute him publicly, but ordered him to be dispatched in a secret part of the palace, and his body to be carried privately away. And, though many of the prince's household, many knights and senators, were said to have supported him with money and assisted him with their counsels, no inquiry followed. At the end of the year, a triumphal arch was raised near the temple of Saturn, as a monument for the recovery of the Varian eagles under the conduct of Germanicus and the auspices of Tiberius. A temple was directed to Happy Fortune near the Tiber, in the gardens bequeathed to the Roman people by Caesar the Dictator. A chapel was consecrated to the Julian family, and statues to the deified Augustus in the suburbs called Bovillae. In the consulship of Caius Celius and Lucius Pomponius, the 6th and 20th of May, Germanicus Caesar triumphed over the Cheruscans, the Catians, the Angrivarians, and the other nations as far as the Elbe. In the triumph were carried all the spoils and captives, with the representations of mountains, of rivers, and of battles, so that his conquests, because he was restrained from completing them, were taken for complete. His own graceful person, and his chariot filled with his 5 children, heightened the shew and the delight of the beholders. Yet they were checked with secret fears, as they remembered that popular favor had proved malignant to his father Drusus, that his uncle Marcellus was snatched in his youth from the burning affections of the populace, and that ever short-lived and unfortunate were the favorites of the Roman people. Tiberius distributed to the people, in the name of Germanicus, 300 sestercec a man, and named himself his colleague in the consulship. Nor even thus did he gain the opinion of tenderness and sincerity. In effect, on pretense of investing the young prince with fresh preferment and honors, he resolved to alienate him from Rome, and, to accomplish it, craftily framed an occasion, or snatched such a one as chance presented. Archelaus had enjoyed the kingdom of Cappadocia now 50 years, a prince under the deep displeasure of Tiberius, because, in his retirement at Rhodes, the king had paid him no sort of court nor distinction, an omission which proceeded from no disdain, but from the warnings given him by the confidants of Augustus. For that the young Caius Caesar, the presumptive heir to the sovereignty, then lived, and was sent to compose and administer the affairs of the East. Hence the friendship of Tiberius was reckoned then dangerous. But when, by the utter fall of the family of the Caesars, he had gained the empire, he enticed Archelaus to Rome, by means of letters from his mother, who, without dissembling her son's resentment, offered the king his mercy, provided he came and in person implored it. He, who was either ignorant of the snare, or dreaded violence if he had appeared to perceive it, hastened to the city, where he was received by Tiberius with great sternness and wrath, and soon after accused as a criminal in the Senate. The crimes alleged against him were mere fictions, yet, as equal treatment is unusual to kings, and to be treated like malefactors intolerable, Archelaus, who was broken with grief as well as age, by choice or fate, ended his life. His kingdom was reduced into a province, and by its revenues Tiberius declared the tax of the 100th penny would be abated, and reduced it for the future to the 200th. At the same time died Antiochus, king of Commagena, as also Philopater, king of Cilicia. And great combustions shook these nations, whilst many of the people desired the Roman government, and many were addicted to domestic monarchy. The princes, too, of Syria and Judea, as they were oppressed with impositions, prayed an abatement of tribute. These affairs, and such as I have above related concerning Armenia, Tiberius represented to the fathers, and that the commotions of the East could only be settled by the wisdom and abilities of Germanicus. For himself, his age now declined, and that of Drusus was not yet sufficiently ripe. The provinces beyond the sea were thence decreed to Germanicus, with authority superior to all those who obtained provinces by lot or the nomination of the prince. But Tiberius had already taken care to remove from the government of Syria Criticus Silenus, one united to Germanicus in domestic alliance, by having betrothed his daughter to Nero, the eldest son of Germanicus. In his room he had preferred Gnaeus Piso, a man of violent temper, incapable of subjection, and heir to all the ferocity and haughtiness of his father Piso, the same who in the civil war assisted the reviving party against Caesar in Africa with vehement efforts, then followed Brutus and Cassius, but had at last leave to come home, yet disdained to sue for any public offices, nay, was even courted by Augustus to accept the consulship. His son, besides his hereditary pride and impetuosity, was elevated with the nobility and wealth of Plancina his wife. Scarce yielded he to Tiberius, and, as men far beneath him, despised the sons of Tiberius. Neither did he doubt, but he was set over Syria on purpose, to defeat all the views of Germanicus. Some even believed that he had to this purpose secret orders from Tiberius, as it was certain that Livia directed Plancina to exert the spirit of the sex, and, by constant emulation and indignities, to persecute Agrippina, for the whole court was rent, and their affection secretly divided between Drusus and Germanicus. Tiberius was partial to Drusus, as his own son by generation. Others loved Germanicus the more for the aversion of his uncle, and for being, by his mother, of more illustrious descent, as Mark Antony was his grandfather, and Augustus his great uncle. On the other side, Pomponius Atticus, a Roman knight, by being the great-grandfather of Drusus, seemed thence to have derived a stain upon the images of the Claudian house. Besides, Agrippina, the wife of Germanicus, did, in the fruitfulness of her body and the reputation of her virtue, far excel Livia, the wife of Drusus. Yet the two brothers lived in amiable dearness and concord, no wife shaken or estranged by the reigning contention amongst their separate friends and adherents. Drusus was soon after sent into Illyricum in order to inure him to war and gain him the affections of the army. Besides, Tiberius thought that the youth, who lived wantoning in the luxuries of Rome, would be reformed in the camp, and that his own security would be enlarged when both his sons were at the head of the legions. But the pretense for sending him was a protection of the Suevians, who were then imploring assistance against the power of the Cheruscans. For these nations, who, since the departure of the Romans, saw themselves no longer threatened with terrors from abroad, and were then particularly engaged in a national competition for glory, had relapsed as usual into their old intestine feuds, and turned their arms upon each other. These two people were equally powerful, their two leaders equally brave, but differently esteemed, as the title of king had drawn upon Maroboduus the hate and aversion of their countrymen, whilst Arminius, as a champion warring for the defence of liberty, was the universal object of popular affection. Hence, not only the Cheruscans and their confederates, they who had been the ancient soldiery of Arminius, took arms, but to him too revolted the Semnones and Langobards, both Suevian nations, and even subjects of Maroboduus. And by their accession he would have exceeded in puissance. But Ingiomerus, with his band of followers, deserted to Maroboduus, for no other cause than disdain. Then an old man and an uncle like himself should obey Arminius, a young man, his nephew. Both armies were drawn out with equal hopes, nor disjointed, like the old German battles, into scattered parties for loose and random attacks. For, by long war with us, they had learnt to follow their ensigns, to strengthen their main body with parties of reserve, and to observe the orders of their generals. Arminius was now on horseback, viewing all the ranks. As he rode through them, he magnified their past feats. Their liberty recovered, the slaughtered legions, the spoils of arms wrested from the Romans, monuments of victory still retained in some of their hands. Upon Maroboduus he fell with contumelious names, as a fugitive, one of no abilities in war, a coward who had sought defense from the gloomy coverts of the Hercynian wood, and then, by gifts and solicitations, courted the alliance of Rome. A betrayer of his country, a lifeguard man of Caesar's, worthy to be exterminated with no less hostile vengeance than in the slaughter of Quintilius Varus they had shewn. Let them only remember so many battles bravely fought. These events, of which particularly the utter expulsion of the Romans, were sufficient proofs with whom remained the glory of the war. Neither did Maroboduus fail to boast himself and appreciate the foe. In the person of Ingiomarus, he said, holding him by the hand, rested the whole renown of the Cheruscans, and from his counsels began all their exploits that ended in success. Arminius, a man of frantic spirit and a novice in affairs, assumed to himself the glory of another, for having by treachery surprised 3 legions, which expected no foe, and their leader, who feared no fraud. A base surprise, revenged since on Germany with heavy slaughters, and on Arminius himself with domestic infamy, while his wife and his son still bore the bonds of captivity. For himself, when attacked formerly by Tiberius at the head of 12 legions, he had preserved unstained the glory of Germany, and on equal terms ended the war. Nor did he repent of the treaty, since it was still in their hands to wage a new equal war with the Romans, or save blood and maintain peace. The armies, besides the incitements from these speeches, were animated by national stimulations of their own. The Cheruscans fought for their ancient renown, the Langobards for their recent liberty, and the Suevians and their king, on the contrary, were struggling for the augmentation of their monarchy. Never did armies make a fiercer onset. Never had onset a more ambiguous event, for both the right wings were routed, and hence a fresh encounter was certainly expected, until Maroboduus drew off his army and encamped upon the hills, a manifest sign that he was humbled. Frequent desertions, too, leaving him at last naked of forces, he retired to the Marcomannians, and thence sent ambassadors to Tiberius to implore succors. They were answered that he had no right to invoke aid of the Roman arms against the Cheruscans, since to the Romans, while they were warring with the same foe, he had never administered any assistance. Drusus was, however, sent away, as I have said, with the character of a negotiator of peace. The same year, 12 noble cities of Asia were overturned by an earthquake. The ruin happened in the night, and the more dreadful as its warnings were unobserved. Neither availed the usual sanctuary against such calamities, namely a flight to the fields, since those who fled, the gaping earth devoured. It is reported that mighty mountains subsided, plains were heaved into high hills, and that with flashes and eruptions of fire, the mighty devastation was everywhere accompanied. The Sardians felt most heavily the rage of the concussion, and therefore most compassion. Tiberius promised them 100,000 great sesterces, and remitted their taxes for 5 years. The inhabitants of Magnesia, under Mount Sipylus, were held next in sufferings, and had proportionable relief. The Temnians, Philadelphians, the Egetians, Apollonians, with those called the Mostynians or Macedonians of Hyrcania, the cities too of Hero Caesarea, Myrnia, Syme, and Smolus, were all for the same term eased of tribute. It was likewise resolved to send one of the Senate to view the desolations and administer proper remedies. Marcus Alatus was therefore chosen, one of Praetorian rank, because a consular senator then governing Asia had another of the like quality been sent, an emulation between equals was apprehended, and consequently opposition and delays. The credit of this noble bounty to the public he increased by private liberalities, which proved equally popular. The estate of the wealthy Emila Musa, claimed by the exchequer as she died intestate, he surrendered to Aemilius Lepidus, to whose family she seemed to belong, as also to Marcus Servilius, the inheritance of Potilius, a rich Roman knight, though part of it he had bequeathed to himself. but he found Servilius named Solher in a former and well-attested will. He said, such was the nobility of both, that they deserved to be supported. Nor did he ever accept to himself any man's inheritance, but where former friendship gave him a title. The wills of such as were strangers to him, and of such as, from hate and prejudice to others, had appointed the prince their heir, he utterly rejected. But as he relieved the honest poverty of the virtuous, so he degraded from the senate, or suffered to quit it of their own accord. Vibidius Varro, Marius Nepos, Appius Appianus, Cornelius Sylla, and Quintius Vitellius, all prodigals, and only through debauchery, indigent. End of section 22.
Section 23 of the Complete Works of Tacitus, edited by Thomas Gordon. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Lizzie Driver. The Complete Works of Tacitus, to which are prefixed political discourses upon that author, edited and translated by Thomas Gordon, with introductory essays by Thomas Gordon. Volume 1. The Annals, Book 2, Part 5. The African Conflicts. About this time, Tiberius finished and consecrated what Augustus began, the temples of the gods consumed by age or fire. That near the great circus, vowed by Aulus Posthumius, the dictator, to Bacchus, Proserpina, and Ceres, in the same place the temple of Flora, founded by Lucius Publicius and Marcus Publicius, while they were aediles, the temple of Janus, built in the herb market, by Caius Duilius, who first signalized the Roman power at sea, and merited a naval triumph over the Carthaginians. That of Hope was dedicated by Germanicus. This temple Attilius had vowed in the same war. The law of violated majesty, in the meantime, waxed intense, and by it an accuser impleaded Apulia Virilia, grandniece to Augustus, by his sister, for that, with opprobrious words, she had revived the defied Augustus, Tiberius, and his mother, and, being nearly allied to the emperor, had stained by adultery the Caesarian blood. Concerning the adultery, sufficient provision was thought already made by the Julian law, and the crimes of state, Tiberius desired, might be separated. If she had uttered impious speeches of Augustus, she must be condemned. But, for invectives against himself, he would not have called her to any account. The council asked him, what would be his sentiments if she were convicted of defaming his mother? To this he made no answer, but, next sitting of the Senate, he prayed too in her name, that no word spoken against her might to anyone be imputed for crimes, and acquitted Apulia of her treason. Of her punishment too for adultery, he begged a mitigation, and prevailed that, by the example of our ancestors, she should be removed by a kindred 200 miles from Rome. Manlius, her adulterer, was interdirected Italy and Africa. A debate at this time arose about substituting a praetor in the room of Vipsanius Gallus, removed by death. Germanicus and Drusus, for they were yet at Rome, espoused Haterius Agrippa, kinsman to Germanicus. Many, on the contrary, insisted that the number of children should decide it, and the candidate who had most be preferred, for this was the voice of the law. Tiberius rejoiced to see the Senate engaged in a contention between his sons and the laws. The law, without doubt, was vanquished, yet not instantly and by a small majority, but with the same struggle that laws were vanquished when laws were in force. This year a war began in Africa, conducted by Tacfarinas. He was a native of Numidia, and had served amongst the auxiliaries in the Roman armies, but, deserting the service, gathered together, by the allurements of booty and rapine, at first a herd of vagabonds and men inured to robberies, then formed them, like an army, into regular companies of foot and troops of horse, under distinct standards and colours. At length he was no longer esteemed the leader of a disorderly gang, but considered as general of the Musulanians. This powerful people, borderers upon the deserts of Africa, still wild and without towns, took arms, and drew into the war the neighbouring Moors. These too had a general of their own, his name Mazippa, and between the two leaders the army was divided. That, whilst Tacfarinas encamped with the best men, armed after the fashions of Romans, and accustomed then to discipline and command, Mazippa, with a flying band, might make excursions on every side, with fire, slaughter, and alarms. They had likewise forced the Cynetheans into their measures, a nation no wise despicable. When furious Camillus, proconsul of Africa, marched against the enemy with one legion, and what troops of the allies were under his command? A handful of men at most, when compared to the multitude of Numidians and Moors. But it was his first care not to intimidate them with numbers, and thence tempt them to elude fighting and prolong the war. Indeed, he gave them hopes of victory, only to enable himself to vanquish them. The legion was placed in the centre, the light cohorts and two wings of horse on the right and left. Nor did Tacfarinas decline the combat. The Numidians were routed, and after a long series of years, military renown recovered to the name of Furius. For since Camillus, the restorer of Rome and his son, the glory of command and victories continued in other families. Even he whom I have mentioned passed for a man destitute of military abilities and experience in war. Hence Tiberius magnified, with the more unfeigned alacrity, his exploits to the Senate, and to him the fathers decreed the ensigns of triumph. Yet to Camillus all the merit and distinction proved a snare, protected as he was by a life singularly modest and retired. The councils for the following year were Tiberius the third time, Germanicus the second. This dignity overtook Germanicus at Nicopolis, a city of Achaia, whither he arrived, by the coast of Illyricum, from visiting his brother Drusus, then abiding in Dalmatia, and had suffered a tempestuous passage, both in the Adriatic and Ionian Sea. He therefore spent a few days to repair his fleet, and viewed the while the Bay of Actium, renowned for the naval victory there, as also the spoils consecrated by Augustus and the camp of Antony, with an affecting remembrance of these his ancestors. For Antony, as I have said, was his great uncle, Augustus his father. Hence this scene proved to Germanicus a mighty source of images pleasing and sad. Next he proceeded to Athens, where, in concession to that ancient city, allied to Rome, he would use but one lictor. The Greeks received him with the most elaborate honours, and, to dignify their personal flattery, carried before him tabulators of the signal deeds and sayings of his ancestors. Hence he sailed to Eubocia, then to Lesbos, where Agrippina was delivered of Julia, who proved her last child. Then he kept the coast of Asia, and visited Perinthus and Byzantium, cities of Thrace, and entered the Straits of Propontis, and the mouth of the Euxine, fond of beholding ancient places long celebrated by fame. He relieved, at the same time, the provinces wherever distracted with intestine factions, or aggravated with the oppressions of their magistrates. In return he strove to see the religious rites of the Samothracians, but, by the violence of the north wind, was repulsed from the shore as he passed. He saw Troy and her remains, venerable for the vicissitude of her fate, and for the birth of Rome. Regaining the coast of Asia, he pulled in at Colophon, to consult there the oracle of the Clarion Apollo. It is no Pythoness that represents the god here, as at Delphos, but a priest, one chosen from certain families, chiefly of Miletus. Neither requires he more than just to hear the names and numbers of the querists, and then descends into the auricular cave, where, after a draught of water from a secret spring, though ignorant for the most part of letters and poetry, he yet utters his answers in verse, which has for its subject the conceptions and wishes of Cash Consultant. He was even said to have sung to Germanicus his hastening fate, but, as oracles are wont, in terms dark and doubtful. Now Cineas Piso, hurrying to the execution of his purposes, terrified the city of Athens by a tempestuous entry, and reproached them in a severe speech with the bleak censure of Germanicus, that, debasing the dignity of the Roman name, he had paid excessive court, not to the Athenians, by so many slaughterers long since extinct, but to the then mixed scum of nations there. For that these were they who had leagued with Mithridates against Sylla, and with Antony against Augustus. He even charged them with the errors and misfortunes of ancient Athens, her impotent attempts against the Macedonians, her violence and ingratitude to her own citizens. He was also an enemy to their city from personal anger, because they would not pardon at his request one Theophilus, condemned by the Areopagus for forgery. From thence, sailing hastily through the Cyclades, and taking the shortest course, he overtook Germanicus at Rhodes, but was there driven by a sudden tempest upon the rocks. And Germanicus, who was not ignorant with what malignity and invectives he was pursued, yet acted with so much humanity, that when he might have left him to perish, and referred to casualty the destruction of his enemy, he dispatched galleys to rescue him from the wreck. This generous kindness, however, assuaged not the animosity of Piso. Scarce could he brook a day's delay with Germanicus, but left him in haste to arrive in Syria before him. Nor was he sooner there, and found himself amongst the legions, than he began to court the common men by bounties and caresses, to assist them with his countenance and credit, to form factions, to remove all the ancient centurions, and every tribune of remarkable discipline and severity, and, in their places, to put dependents of his own, or men recommended only by their crimes. He permitted sloth in the camp, licentiousness in the towns, a rambling and disorderly soldiery, and carried the corruption so high, that in the discourses of the herd he was styled father of the legions. Nor did Plancina restrain herself to a conduct seemly in her sex, but frequented the exercises of the cavalry, and attended the decursions of the cohorts. Everywhere in weighing against Agrippina, everywhere against Germanicus. And some, even of the most deserving soldiers, became prompt to base obedience, from a rumour whispered abroad, that all this was not unacceptable to Tiberius. These doings were all known to Germanicus, but his more instant care was to visit Armenia, an inconstant and restless nation from the beginning, from the genius of the people, as well as from the situation of their country, which, bordering with a large frontier on our provinces, and stretching thence quite to Media, is enclosed between the two great empires, and often at variance with them. With the Romans through antipathy and hatred, with the Parthians through competition and envy. At this time, and ever since the removal of Annonus, they had no king, but the affections of the nations leaned towards Zeno, son of Polemon, king of Pontus, because, by an attachment from his infancy, to the fashions and customs of the Armenians, by hunting, feasting, and other usages practised and renowned amongst the barbarians, he had equally won the nobles and people. Upon his head, therefore, at the city of Artaxiter, with the approbation of the nobles, in a great assembly, Germanicus put the regal diadem, and the Armenians, doing homage to their king, saluted him Artaxius, a name which from that of their city they gave him. The Cappadocians, at this time reduced into the form of a province, received for their governor Quintus Varinius, and to raise their hopes of the gentler dominion of Rome, several of the royal taxes were lessened. Quintus Servius was set over the Commagenians, then first subjected to the jurisdiction of a praetor. From the affairs of the allies, thus all successfully settled, Germanicus reaped no pleasure, through the perverseness and pride of Piso, who was ordered to lead, by himself or his son, part of the legions into Armenia, but contemptuously neglected to do either. They at last met at Sirium, the winter quarters of the 10th legion, whither each came with a prepared countenance. Piso to betray no fear, and Germanicus would not be thought to threaten. He was indeed, as I have observed, of a humane and reconcilable spirit, but officious friends, expert at inflaming animosities, aggravated real offences, added fictitious, and with manifold imputations charged Piso, Placinia, and their sons. To this interview Germanicus admitted a few intimates, and began his complaints in such words as dissembled resentment usually dictates. Piso replied with disdainful submissions, and they parted in open enmity. Piso hereafter came rarely to the tribunal of Germanicus, or, if he did, sate sternly there, and in manifest opposition. He likewise published his spite at a feast of the Nabathean kings, where golden crowns of great weight were presented to Germanicus and Agrippania. But to Piso and the rest, such as were light. "This banquet," he said, "was made for the son of a Roman prince, not a Parthian monarch." With these words he cast away his crown, and uttered many invectives against luxury. Sharp insults upon Germanicus, yet he bore them. At this time arrived ambassadors from Artabanus, king of the Parthians. He sent them to represent the state of the mutual league and friendship between the two empires, how desirous he was to renew it, that, in honour to Germanicus, he would come to receive him as far as the banks of the Euphrates, and requested, in the meantime, that Venones might not be continued in Syria, lest, taking the advantage of so near a neighbourhood, he should, by corresponding with the grandees of Parthia, engage in civil dissension and rebellion. The answer given by Germanicus, as far as related to the alliance of the Romans and the Parthians, was conceived in terms of dignity and grandeur. But of the coming of the king and the court and veneration intended to himself, he spoke with becoming complacence and modesty. Venones was removed to Pompeiopolis, a maritime city of Cilicia, a concession made, not to the request of Artabanus only, but in contumely to Piso, with whom Venones was in high favour, for the assiduous court and many presents, by which he had won Plancina. In the consulship of Marcus Silanus and Lucius Norbanus, Germanicus travelled to Egypt, to view the famous antiquities of the country. Though, for the motives of the journey, the care and inspection of the province were publicly alleged. And indeed, by opening the granaries, he mitigated the price of corn, and practised many things grateful to the people. Walking without guards, his feet bare, and his habit the same with that of the Greeks, after the example of Publius Scipio, who, we are told, was constant in the same practices in Sicily, even during the rage of the Punic War there. For these he assumed manners and foreign habit. Tiberius blamed him in a gentle style, but censured him with great asperity for violating an establishment of Augustus, and entering Alexandria without consent of the prince. For Augustus, amongst other secrets of power, had set apart and appropriated Egypt, and restrained the senators and dignified Roman knights from going thither without license. As he apprehended that Italy might be distressed with famine by any who seized that province, the key to the empire by sea and land, and defensible by a light band of men against potent armies. Germanicus, not yet informed that his journey was censured, sailed up the Nile. Beginning at Canopus, one of its mouths, built by the Spartans, as a monument to Canopus, a pilot buried there, at the time when Menelaus, returning to Greece, was driven to different seas in the Liberian continent. Hence he visited the next mouth of the river, sacred to Hercules. Him the natives aver to have been born amongst them, that he was the most ancient of the name, and that all the rest, who with equal virtues followed his example, were in honour called after him. Next he visited the mighty antiquities of ancient Thebes, where upon huge obelisks yet remained Egyptian characters, describing its former opulency. One of the oldest priests was ordered to interpret them. He said they related that it once contained 700,000 fighting men, that with that army King Ramesses had conquered Libya, Ethiopia, the Medes and Persians, the Bactrians and Scythians, and to his empire had added the territories of the Syrians, Armenians, and the neighbours the Cappadocians, a tract of countries reaching from the Sea of Bithynia to that of Lycia. Here also was read the assessment of tribute laid on the several nations, what weight of silver and gold, what number of horses and arms, what ivory and perfumes, as gift to the temples, what measures of grain, what quantities of all necessaries were by each people paid, revenues equally grand with those extracted by the domination of the Parthians, or by the power of the Romans. Germanicus was intent upon seeing other wonders. The chiefs were the effigies of Memnon, a colossus of stone, yielding, when struck by the solar rays, a vocal found. The pyramids rising, like mountains, amongst rolling and almost impassable waves of sand, proud monuments of the emulation and opulency of Egyptian kings. The artificial lake, a receptacle of the overflowing Nile, and elsewhere abysses of such immense depth that those who tried could never fathom. Thence he proceeded to Elephantina and Cyane, two islands, formerly frontiers of the Roman Empire, which is now widened to the Red Sea. While Germanicus spent this summer in several provinces, Drusus was sowing feuds among the Germans, and thence reaped no light reward. And, as the power from Aroboduus was already broken, he engaged them to persist and complete his ruin. Amongst the Gotonis was a young man of quality. His name Catualda, a fugitive long since from the violence of Marbodoas, but now, in his distress, resolved on revenge. Hence, with a stout hand, he entered the borders of the Marcomannians, and, corrupting their chiefs into his alliance, stormed the regal palace and the castle situate near it. In the pillage were found the ancient stores of prey accumulated by the Suevians, as also many victuallers and traders from our provinces, men who were drawn hither from their several homes, first by privilege of traffic, then retained by a passion to multiply gain, and at last, through utter oblivion of their own country, fixed like natives in a hostile soil. To Maroboduus, on every side forsaken, no other refuge remained but the mercy of Caesar. He therefore passed the Danube, where it washes the province of Norica, and wrote to Tiberius, not, however, in the language of a fugitive or supplicant, but with a spirit suitable to his late grandeur, that many nations invited him to them, as a king once so glorious, but he preferred to all the friendship or Rome. The emperor answered that in Italy he should have a safe and honourable retreat, and, when his affairs required his presence, the same security to return. But to the Senate he declined, that never had Philip of Macedon been so terrible to the Athenians, nor Pyrrhus, nor Antiochus to the Roman people. The speech is extant. In it he magnifies the greatness of the man, the fierceness and bravery of the nations his subjects, the alarming nearness of such an enemy to Italy, and his own artful measures to destroy him. Maroboduus was kept at Ravenna, for a check and terror to the Suevians, as if, when at any time they grew turbulent, he were there in readiness to recover their subjugation. Yet in 18 years he left not Italy, but grew old in exile there. His renown, too, became eminently diminished. Such was the price he paid for an over-passionate love of life. The same sate at Catualda, and no other sanctuary. He was soon after expulsed by the forces of the Hermundurians, led by Vibulius, and, being received under the Roman protection, was conveyed to Forum Julium, a colony in Narbonne, Gaul. The barbarians, their followers, lest had they been mixed with the provinces, they might have disturbed their present quiet, were placed beyond the Danube, between the rivers Marius and Corsus, and for their king had assigned them Vannius, by nation Aquadian. End of section 23.
Section 24 of the Complete Works of Tacitus, edited by Thomas Gordon. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Graham Redman. The Complete Works of Tacitus, to which are prefixed political discourses upon that author, edited and translated by Thomas Gordon, with introductory essays by Thomas Gordon. Volume 1. The Annals, Book 2, Section 6, The Death of Germanicus. As soon as it was known at Rome that Artaxias was by Germanicus given to the Armenians for their king, the fathers decreed to him and Drusus the lesser triumph. Triumphal arches were likewise erected on each side the temple of Mars the Avenger, supporting the statues of these two Caesars. And for Tiberius, he was more joyful to have established peace by policy than if by battles and victories he had ended the war. He therefore also assailed by the ways of craft Rescuporis, a king of Thrace. That whole nation had been subject to Remetalces, but upon his death one moiety was by Augustus granted to Rescuporis, his brother, and one to Cotys, his son. In this partition the vales, cities, and territories bounding upon Greece fell to Cotys. To Rescuporis the wilds, the hills, and the parts exposed to a hostile neighbourhood. The two kings were likewise dissonant in their genius, the former mild and agreeable, the latter cruel, rapacious, and impatient of equality. Yet at first they lived in hollow friendship, but in a while Rescuporis began to break bounds, to seize for himself the portions of Cotys, and, where he met resistance, to exercise violence. Cautiously, it is true, and by degrees in the life of Augustus, to whose grant they owed both their kingdoms, and if his authority had been despised, his vengeance was dreaded. But upon the change of emperors he poured in bands of robbers, demolished forts, and thus sought to provoke war. Tiberius was about no consideration of state so anxious as that things once settled should never after be molested. he instantly dispatched a centurion to the two kings to forbid their proceeding to a decision by arms, and Cotys forthwith dismissed the forces he had raised. Rescuperus feigned submission and desired an interview, for that by treaty, he said, they might adjust all their differences. And upon the time, the place, and even upon the conditions, they quickly agreed, while one, through easiness, one, through fraud, yielded and accepted every proposition. Rescuperus, for a sanction, as he pretended to the league, added a banquet, and the festivity and drinking was prolonged till midnight, when Cotys, warm with wine and feasting, and void of circumspection, was suddenly loaded with chains, deprecating in vain the brutal treachery by the inviolable rights of kings, by the common gods of their family, by that very banquet of sacred pledge of concord and hospitality. Rescuperus, having now seized all Thrace, wrote to Tiberius that bloody snares were contrived for him, but he had anticipated the contriver. And, pretending a war against the Bastarnians and Scythians, fortified himself with new forces, horse and foot. He had a soft answer, that if he had practised no guile he might securely trust to his innocence. But neither could he himself nor the Senate, without hearing the cause, distinguish between justice and violence, that therefore, delivering up Cotys, he should come, and upon him effectually transfer the odium of the crime. This letter Latinius Pandus, pro praetor of Mysia, transmitted to Thrace by the soldiers sent to receive Cotys. Rescuperus, wavering long between fear and rage, determined at last rather to be guilty of a finished than an imperfect villainy. He caused Cotys to be murdered, and belied his death as if by his own hands it had been procured. Neither yet did Tiberius change his favourite course of dissembling, but upon the death of Pandus, whom Rescuperus alleged to have been his enemy, preferred to the government of Mysia Pomponius Flaccus, an ancient officer, one in close friendship with the king, and by it more qualified to betray him. Hence chiefly he was preferred. Flaccus passed into Thrace, and, though he found him full of hesitation and revolving with great dismay upon the crying horror of his own wickedness, yet by mighty promises prevailed upon him to enter the Roman barrier. Here the king, on pretence of solemnity and honour, was surrounded with a strong party and a crowd of officers, who pressed him by earnest exhortations and many arguments, and the further they travelled, the more apparent to him was his confinement, so that at last, convinced of the necessity of going, he was by them haled to Rome. He was accused before the Senate by the wife of Cotys, and condemned to exile far from his kingdom. Thrace was divided between Rematalces, his son, who, it was manifest, had opposed all his father's outrageous measures, and the sons of Cotys. These were minors, and placed with their kingdom under the administration of Trebellianus Rufus, formerly praetor, after the example of our ancestors, who sent Marcus Lepidus into Egypt in quality of guardian to the children of Ptolemy. Rescuperus was transported to Alexandria, and there slain attempting flight, or falsely charged with it. At the same time Venones, who had been removed, as I have above related, into Cilicia, corrupted his keepers and endeavoured to escape to Armenia, thence to the Albanians and Heniocians, and then to his kinsman the king of Scythia. Thus, pretending to hunt, and avoiding the maritime coasts, he gained the devious recesses of the forests, and then, on a sudden, rode full speed to the river Pyramus. But the countrymen, apprised of the king's flight, had broken the bridges. Neither was the stream to be forded. Upon the banks, therefore, of the river he was by Vibius Fronto, general of horse, put in bonds, and presently after, by Remius, a resumed veteran, lately his keeper, run through in affected wrath with a sword. Hence arose the stronger belief that, from consciousness of fraud and dread of discovery, Vonones was slain. Germanicus, returning from Egypt, learned that all his orders left with the legions and the eastern cities were either entirely abolished or contrary regulations established, a ground for his severe resentment and reproaches upon Piso. Nor less keen were the efforts and machinations of Piso against Germanicus. Yet Piso afterwards determined to leave Syria, but was detained by the following illness of Germanicus. Again, when he heard of his recovery, and perceived that vows were paid for his restoration, the lictors, by his command, broke the solemnity, drove away the victims already at the altars, overturned the apparatus of the sacrifice, and scattered the people of Antioch employed in celebrating the festival. He then departed to Seleucia, waiting the event of the malady which had again assaulted Germanicus. His own persuasion, too, that poison was given him by Piso, heightened the cruel vehemence of the disease. Indeed, upon the floors and walls were found fragments of human bodies, the spoils of the grave, with charms and incantations, and the name of Germanicus graved on sheets of lead, carcasses half-burnt, besmeared with gore, and other witchcrafts by which souls are thought doomed to the infernal gods. Besides, there were certain persons, charged as creatures of Piso, purposely sent and employed to watch the progress and efforts of the disease. These things filled Germanicus with apprehensions great as his resentment. If his doors, he said, were besieged, if under the eyes of his enemies he must render up his spirit, what was to be expected to his unhappy wife, what to his infant children? The progress of poison was thought too slow. Piso was impatient, and urging with eagerness to command alone the legions, to possess alone the province. But Germanicus was not sunk to such lowness and impotence that the price of his murder should remain with the murderer. And by a letter to Piso he renounced his friendship. Some add that he commanded him to depart the province. Nor did Piso tarry longer, but took ship, yet checked her sailing, in order to return with the more quickness should the death of Germanicus the while leave the government of Syria vacant. Germanicus, after a small revival drooping again, when his end approached, spoke on this wise to his attending friends. "Were I to yield to the destiny of nature, just even then were my complaints against the gods for hurrying me from my parents, my children, and my country by a hasty death in the prime of life. Now, shortened in my course by the malignity of Piso and his wife, to your breasts I commit my last prayers. Tell my father, tell my brother, with what violent persecutions afflicted, with what mortal snares circumvented, I end a most miserable life by death of all others the worst. All they whose hopes in my fortune, all they whose kindred blood, and even they whose envy possess them with impressions about me whilst living, shall bewail me dead, that once great in glory, and surviving so many wars, I fell at last by the dark devices of a woman. To you place will be left to complain in the Senate, place to invoke the aid and vengeance of the laws. To commemorate the dead with slothful wailings is not the principal office of friends. They are to remember his dying wishes, to fulfil his last desires. Even strangers will lament Germanicus. You are my friends. If you loved me rather than my fortune, you will vindicate your friendship. Show the people of Rome my wife, her who is the granddaughter of Augustus, and enumerate to them our offspring, even six children. Their compassion will surely attend you who accuse, and the accused, if they pretend clandestine warrants of iniquity, will not be believed, if believed, not pardoned. His friends, as a pledge of their fidelity, touching the hand of the dying prince, swore that they would forego their lives sooner than their revenge. Then, turning to his wife, he besought her that in tenderness to his memory, in tenderness to their common children, she would banish her haughty spirit, yield to her hostile fortune, nor upon her return to Rome, by an impotent competition for ruling, irritate those who were masters of rule. So much openly, and more in secret, whence he was believed to have warned her of guile and danger from Tiberius. Soon after he expired, to the heavy sorrow of the province and of all the neighbouring countries, insomuch that remote nations and foreign kings were mourners. Such had been his complacency to our confederates, such his humanity to his enemies. Alike venerable he was, whether you saw him or heard him, and without ever departing from the grave port and dignity of his sublime rank, he yet lived destitute of arrogance and untouched by envy. The funeral, which was performed without exterior pomp or a procession of images, drew its solemnity from the loud praises and amiable memory of his virtues. There were those who, from the loveliness of his person, his age, his manner of dying, and even from the proximity of places where both departed, compared him in the circumstances of his fate to the great Alexander. Each of a graceful person, each of illustrious descent, in years neither much exceeding 30, both victims to the malice and machinations of their own people in the midst of foreign nations. But Germanicus, gentle towards his friends, his pleasures moderate, confined to one wife, all his children by one bed, nor less a warrior, though not so rash, however hindered from a final reduction of Germany, broken by him in so many victories and ready for the yoke. So that, had he been sole arbiter of things, had he acted with the sovereignty and title of royalty, he had easier overtaken him in the glory of conquests, as he surpassed him in clemency, in moderation, and in other virtues. His body, before its commitment to the pile, was exhibited naked in the Forum of Antioch, the place where the pile was erected. Whether it bore the marks of poison remained undecided, for people, as they were divided in their affections, as they pitied Germanicus and presumed the guilt of Piso, or were partial to him, gave opposite accounts. It was next debated amongst the legates of the legions and the other senators there, to whom should be committed the administration of Syria, and after the faint efforts of others it was long disputed between Vibius Marsus and Cneius Sentius. Marsus at last yielded to Sentius, the older man and the more vehement competitor. By him one Martina, infamous in that province for practices in poisoning and a close confidant of Plancina, was sent to Rome at the suit of Vitellius, Varanius, and others, who were preparing criminal articles against Piso and Plancina as against persons evidently guilty. Agrippina, though overwhelmed with sorrow and her body indisposed, yet impatient of all delays to her revenge, embarked with the ashes of Germanicus and her children, attended with universal commiseration. That a lady in quality a princess, wont to be beheld in her late splendid wedlock with applauses and adorations, was now seen bearing in her bosom her husband's funeral urn, uncertain of vengeance for him and fearful for herself, unfortunate in her fruitfulness, and from so many children obnoxious to so many blows of fortune. Piso, the while, was overtaken at the Isle of Coos by a message that Germanicus was deceased, and received it intemperately, slew victims, and repaired with thanksgiving to the temples. Yet however immoderate and undisguised was his joy, more arrogant and insulting proved that of Plancina, who immediately threw off her mourning, which for the death of a sister she wore, and assumed a dress adapted to gaiety and gladness. About him flocked the centurions with officious representations, that upon him particularly were bent the affections and zeal of the legions, and he should proceed to resume the province, at first injuriously taken from him, and now destitute of a governor. As he therefore consulted what he had best pursue, his son Marcus Piso advised a speedy journey to Rome. Hitherto, he said, nothing past expiation was committed, neither were impotent suspicions to be dreaded, nor the idle blazonings of fame. His variance and contention with Germanicus was, perhaps, subject to popular hate and aversion, but to no prosecution or penalty, and by bereaving him of the province his enemies were gratified. But if he returned thither, as Sentius would certainly oppose him with arms, a civil war would thence be actually begun. Neither would the centurions and soldiers persist in his party, men with whom the recent memory of their late commander and an inveterate love to the Caesars in general were still prevalent. Domitius Sylla, one in intimate credit with Piso, argued on the contrary that the present event must by all means be improved. It was Piso and not Sentius who had commission to govern Syria. Upon him were conferred the jurisdiction of praetor and the badges of magistracy, and with him the legions were entrusted. So that if acts of hostility were by his opponents attempted, with how much better warrant could he avow assuming arms in his own right and defence, who was thus vested with the authority of general, and acted under special orders from the emperor. Rumours, too, were to be neglected and left to perish with time. In truth, to the sallies and violence of recent hate, the innocent were often unequal. But were he once possessed of the army, and had well augmented his forces, many things not to be foreseen would from fortune derive success. Are we then preposterously hastening to arrive at Rome with the ashes of Germanicus, that you may there fall, unheard and undefended, a victim to the wailings of Agrippina, a prey to the passionate populace governed by the first impressions of rumour? Livia, it is true, is your confederate, Tiberius is your friend, but both secretly, and indeed none will more pompously bewail the violent fate of Germanicus than such as do most sincerely rejoice for it. Piso, of himself prompt to violent pursuits, was with no great labour persuaded into this opinion, and, in a letter transmitted to Tiberius, accused Germanicus of luxury and pride, that for himself he had been expulsed to leave room for dangerous designs against the state, and now resumed with his former faith and loyalty the care of the army. In the meantime he put Domitius on board a galley, and ordered him to avoid appearing upon the coasts or amongst the isles, but through the main sea to sail to Syria. The deserters, who from all quarters were flocking to him in crowds, he formed into companies, and armed all the retainers to the camp. Then, sailing over to the continent, intercepted a regiment of recruits upon their march into Syria, and wrote to the small kings of Cilicia to assist him with present succours. Nor was the younger Piso slow in prosecuting all the measures of war, though to adventure a war had been against his sentiments and advice. As they coasted Lycia and Pamphylia, they encountered the ships which carried Agrippina, with hostile spirits on each side, and each at first prepared for combat. But as equal dread of one another possessed both, they proceeded not further than mutual contumelies. Vibius Marsus particularly summoned Piso as a criminal to Rome, there to make his defence. He answered with derision that when the praetor who was to sit upon poisonings had assigned a day to the accusers and the accused, he would attend. Domitius, the while, landing at Laodicea, a city of Syria, would have proceeded to the winter quarters of the 6th Legion, which he believed to be the most prone to engage in novel attempts, but was prevented by Pacuvius, its commander. Sentius represented this by letter to Piso, and warned him at his peril to infect the camp by ministers of corruption, or to assail the province by war, and drew into a body such as he knew loved Germanicus, or such as were averse to his foes. Upon them he inculcated with much ardour that Piso was with open arms attacking the majesty of the prince, and invading the Roman state, and then marched at the head of a puissant body, equipped for battle, and resolute to engage. Neither failed Piso, though his enterprises had thus far miscarried, to apply the securest remedies to his present perplexities, and therefore seized a castle of Cilicia strongly fortified, its name Celendris. For to the auxiliary Cilicians sent him by the petty kings he had joined his body of deserters, as also the recruits lately intercepted, with all his own and Plancina's slaves, and thus in number and bulk had of the whole composed a legion. To them he thus harangued, "I, who am the lieutenant of Caesar, am yet violently excluded from the province which to me Caesar has committed, not excluded by the legions, for by their invitation I am arrived, but by Sentius, who thus disguises under feigned crimes against me his own animosity and personal hate. But with confidence you may stand in battle, where the opposite army upon the site of Piso, a commander lately by themselves styled their father, will certainly refuse to fight. They know, too, that were right to decide it, I am the stronger, and of no mean puissance in a trial at arms." He then arrayed his men without the fortifications on a hill steep and craggy, for all the rest was begirt by the sea. Against them stood the veterans, regularly embattled, and supported with a body of reserve, so that here appeared the force of men, there only the terror and stubbornness of situation. On Piso's side was no spirit, no hope, nor even weapons, save those of rustics, for instant necessity hastily acquired. As soon as they came to blows, the issue was no longer doubtful than while the Roman cohorts struggled up the steep. The Cilicians then fled and shut themselves up in the castle. Piso, having the while attempted in vain to storm the fleet, which rode at a small distance, as soon as he returned, presented himself upon the walls, where, by a succession of passionate complaints and entreaties, now bemoaning in agonies the bitterness of his lot, then calling and cajoling every particular soldier by his name, and by rewards tempting all, he laboured to excite a sedition, and thus much he had already effected, that the eagle-bearer of the 6th Legion revolted to him with his eagle. This alarmed Sentius, and instantly he commanded the cornets and trumpets to sound, a mount to be raised, the ladders placed, and the bravest men to mount, and others to pour from the engines volleys of darts and stones and flaming torches. The obstinacy of Piso was at last vanquished, and he desired that upon delivering his arms he might remain in the castle till the emperor's pleasure, to whom he would commit the government of Syria, were known, conditions which were not accepted, nor was aught granted him save ships and a passport to Rome. After the illness of Germanicus became noised abroad there, and all its circumstances, like rumours magnified by distance, were related with many aggravations, sadness seized the people. They burned with indignation, and even poured out in plaints the anguish of their souls. For this, they said, he had been banished to the extremities of the empire. For this the province of Syria was committed to Piso, and these the fruits of Livia's mysterious conferences with Plancina. Truly had our fathers spoken concerning his father Drusus, that the possessors of rule beheld with an evil eye the popular spirit of their sons, nor for aught else were they sacrificed, but for their equal treatment of the Roman people, and studying to restore the popular state. These lamentations of the populace were, upon the tidings of his death, so inflamed, that without staying for an edict from the magistrates, without a decree of senate, they by general consent assumed a vacation. The public courts were deserted, private houses shut up. Prevalent everywhere were the symptoms of woe, heavy groans, dismal silence. The whole a scene of real sorrow, and nothing devised for form or show. And though they forbore not to bear the exterior marks and habiliments of mourning, in their souls they mourned still deeper. Accidentally some merchants from Syria, who had left Germanicus still alive, brought more joyful news of his condition. These were instantly believed and instantly proclaimed. Each, as fast as they met, informed others, who forthwith conveyed their light information with improvements and accumulated joy to more. All flew with exultation through the city, and, to pay their thanks and vows, burst open the temple doors. The night, too, heightened their credulity, and affirmation was bolder in the dark. Nor did Tiberius restrain the course of these fictions, but left them to vanish with time. Hence, with more bitterness, they afterwards grieved for him, as if anew snatched from them. Honours were invented and decreed to Germanicus, various as the affections and genius of the particular senators who proposed them. That his name should be sung in the Salian hymns, curule chairs placed for him amongst the priests of Augustus, and over these chairs oaken crowns hung. His statue in ivory precede in the Circensian games. None but one of the Julian race be, in the room of Germanicus, created flamen or augur. Triumphal arches were added, one at Rome, one upon the banks of the Rhine, one upon Mount Amanus in Syria, with inscriptions of his exploits, and a testimony subjoined that he died for the commonwealth. A sepulchre at Antioch, where his corpse was burnt. A tribunal at Epidaphne, the place where he ended his life. The multitude of statues, the many places where divine honours were appointed to be paid him, would not be easily recounted. They would have also decreed him, as to one of the masters of eloquence, a golden shield, signal in bulk as in metal. But Tiberius offered to dedicate one himself, such as was usual, and of a like size with others, for that eloquence was not measured by fortune, and it was sufficient glory if he were ranked with ancient writers. The battalion called after the name of the Junii was now, by the equestrian order, entitled the Battalion of Germanicus, and a rule made that on every 15th of July these troops should follow as their standard the effigies of Germanicus. Of these honours many continue. Some were instantly omitted, or by time are utterly obliterated. In the height of this public sorrow, Livia, sister to Germanicus and married to Drusus, was delivered of male twins, an event even in middling families rare and acceptable, and to Tiberius such mighty matter of joy that he could not refrain boasting to the fathers that to no Roman of the same eminence before him were ever two children born at a birth. For to his own glory he turned all things, even things fortuitous. But to the people, at such a sad conjuncture, it brought fresh anguish, as they feared that the family of Drusus, thus increased, would press heavily upon that of Germanicus. The same year the lubricity of women was by the Senate restrained with severe laws, and it was provided that no woman should become venal if her father, grandfather, or husband were Roman knights. For Vestilia, a lady born of a praetorian family, had, before the aediles, published herself a prostitute upon a custom allowed by our ancestors, who thought that prostitutes were, by thus avowing their infamy, sufficiently punished. Titidius Labeo, too, was questioned that in the manifest guilt of his wife he had neglected the punishment prescribed by the law, but he alleged that the 60 days allowed for consultation were not elapsed, and it was deemed sufficient to proceed against Vestilia, who was banished to the Isle of Seriphus. Measures were also taken for exterminating the solemnities of the Jews and Egyptians, and by decree of Senate 4,000 descendants of franchised slaves, all tainted with that superstition but of proper strength and age, were to be transported to Sardinia to restrain the Sardinian robbers. And if, through the malignity of the climate, they perished, despicable would be the loss. The rest were doomed to depart Italy, unless by a stated day they renounced their profane rites. After this, Tiberius represented that to supply the place of Oxia, who had presided 57 years with the highest sanctimony over the Vestals, another virgin was to be chosen, and thanked Fontius Agrippa and Asinius Pollio that, by offering their daughters, they contended in good offices towards the commonwealth. Pollio's daughter was preferred, for nothing else but that her mother had ever continued in the same wedlock, for Agrippa, by a divorce, had impaired the credit of his house. Upon her who was postponed, Tiberius in consolation bestowed for her fortune 1,000 great sesterces. As the people murmured at the severe dearth of corn, he settled grain at a price certain to the buyer, and undertook to pay 14 pence a measure to the seller. Neither yet would he accept the name of father of his country, a title offered him before, and for these bounties now again. Nay, he sharply rebuked such as styled these provisions of his divine occupations, and him lord. Hence freedom of speech became cramped and insecure under such a prince, one who dreaded liberty and abhorred flattery. I find in the writers of those times, some of them senators, that in the Senate were read letters from Adgandestrius, prince of the Cattians, undertaking to dispatch Arminius if in order to it poison were sent him, and an answer returned that not by frauds and blows in the dark, but armed and in the face of the sun the Roman people took vengeance on their foes. In this Tiberius gained equal glory with our ancient captains, who rejected and disclosed a plot to poison King Pyrrhus. Arminius, however, who, upon the departure of the Romans and expulsion of Maroboduus, aimed at royalty, became thence engaged in a struggle against the liberty of his country, and in defence of their liberty his countrymen took arms against him, so that while with various fortune he contended with them, he fell by the treachery of his own kindred. The deliverer of Germany, without doubt he was, one who assailed the Roman power not like other kings and leaders in its first elements, but in its highest pride and elevation, one sometimes beaten in battle, but never conquered in war. 37 years he lived, 12 he commanded, and amongst these barbarous nations his memory is still celebrated in their songs, though his name be unknown in the annals of the Greeks, who only admire their own national exploits and renown, nor even amongst the Romans does this great captain bear much distinction, while overlooking instances of modern prowess and glory, we only delight to magnify men and feats of old. End of section 24.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.